This morning, for once, I have decided to do what a number of churches up and down Peachtree Street are doing this very moment. I'm going to talk about hell, okay? I might even refer to the devil once or twice, since the two kind of go together. And before you go running to the exits, as you might expect, my take on these things probably won't get me an invitation to any Methodist or Presbyterian churches in the near future, but that's okay. I gave up hope of doing that a long time ago when I first realized that I, along with everyone else on the planet, am a perfect spiritual being in human form, and that the God of my understanding is a God who loves me and supports me and would not think for a moment about punishing me. And when you get ideas like that into your head, this whole threatening idea of Satan and the fires of hell kind of loses its power over your life. You lose the drama. But I still find that there are a lot of people in the world who prefer to be scared into doing what's right instead of doing it because it's a more interesting and enjoyable way to live. Go figure. So, speaking of hell, there's a story that I love. I've known it for many years, but it's one of my favorites. And it's about a man who was out driving one night on a dark, lonely, two-lane road, and there was a semi-truck coming towards him, and the lights were a little bright, and the semi drifted over into his lane and hit him head-on. Well, when the man woke up some time later, he was sitting on the grass in a beautiful park. The sky was blue, the sun was warm, the air was cool, and all around him were these happy, healthy people. They were walking and jogging and riding bicycles and holding hands. There were children and dogs playing in the park. So he tried to ask a few people what was going on, where was he, but they just smiled and they told him to relax and to be patient. So he walked around for about 30 minutes or so, but it didn't take him too long to figure out that he was dead, that he had been killed in the accident. So as he was trying to get his mind around that idea, a well-dressed, nice-looking gentleman came up to him and said, "How do you do, sir? My name is Satan. Welcome to hell. Is everything to your satisfaction?" And the man says, "Excuse me?" And Satan smiles. He laughs. He says, "Yes, sir, I know this must be confusing, but let me show you around." So he proceeds to take the man to his lovely new home where he'll be living for all eternity with a maid and a butler and a very attractive 19-year-old personal assistant. Pick the gender, fill in your blank, it's your fantasy, okay. So they walked into the lovely little village nearby, and there were all these fantastic restaurants with excellent food, all free, no calories. Wonderful, beautiful people serving and at all the clothing stores and everything was free. And eventually they reached the end of Main Street. Satan was charming, and they were just about to turn around and take him home when the man looked around the corner of the last building. And about a half mile away, there was this huge pile of burning coal, and there were these people lying in it with their skin burning off, and they were screaming, and these demons were stabbing them with pitchforks, and he screams, "Oh my God, what's that?" And Satan shrugs his shoulders and shakes his head, and he says, "Oh, that's the Baptists. They prefer it that way." Okay, now, some of you have heard that before, I know, but I love it, okay? You can go online and get it and memorize it and use it on your friends if you want. Now, that's kind of why I want to talk about this subject today, because we should never underestimate the power that fear and punishment can have over our thoughts, our beliefs, and our attitudes, let alone our behavior. That's why so many supposedly religious people like to claim, "The devil made me do it." I love what Mark Twain said. Somebody asked him what he thought about the devil, and he said that anyone who controls over 80% of the human race at least deserves our respect for his executive capabilities, which I thought was good. You see, this character that we refer to, the world refers to as the devil or Satan or whatever they talk about in this language, has changed quite a bit over the years. Originally, and we're talking a couple thousand years ago, more than that even, the whole concept of the devil was not about this evil-looking character. It was about a very friendly but clever trickster, I guess you'd call him, who constantly tempted or challenged people in order to strengthen their spirituality, not to deprive them of it. In the Native American traditions, they call this the coyote. It's very, very similar. In other words, his purpose was not to steal our soul and drag us to hell. It was to make us more aware of our inner doubts and weaknesses so that we could heal them, So he was actually a good guy. It wasn't until the Christian movement really started becoming strong about 350 years after the death of the teacher Jesus that the devil became the bad guy that everybody wanted to blame for all of the world's problems. So just to get us started today, let me get a little frame of reference. How many of you enlightened spiritual beings who have left your traditional religious education behind, how many of you people right now believe in hell? Okay? I see a couple hands. Okay. How many of you do not believe in hell at all? Okay, hands? Good. Okay, that tells me where we are. And the reason I wanted to ask that is to get a feel for where we are because, and this may surprise you, I do believe in hell. And so, by the way, if you read our textbook, does Dr. Holmes. In fact, we have all been there a number of times, whether you know it or not. And it's not as hopeless a place as we have been told. In fact, I maintain, and this is what the talk about today, I maintain that a better concept of what hell is could be very useful to our spiritual growth and understanding. That's what we're going to talk about for the next few minutes. From what I have read and learned, and I've read a lot of it, since I've been studying metaphysics, the reason the idea of hell has such a fearful, negative, destructive hold on so many people is not because they believe so strongly in something that doesn't exist. It's because they believe the wrong things about something that actually does exist. You get the difference? Okay. By this I mean a large number of people and teachings and religions have a lot of fearful, negative and self-limiting misconceptions about something, the idea of hell, that has the potential to be a very positive and constructive spiritual ideas. So if we could remove those misconceptions, not just from those people in those religions, but from all of us, and begin to understand where this fear-based idea came from and the valuable purpose that hell can serve in our overall spiritual understanding, we could actually expand our ability to live life in a better, more loving, and more joyful way, which is something we all want to do. Now, the first misconception about hell that has been taught extensively through the centuries, and there are three misconceptions I want to talk about today, is the belief that hell is an actual place. That's first. Now, most educated people today aren't too caught up in that idea, except for the real heavy-duty fundamentalists, Christians, a few of the Catholics, whatever. I do remember that David Leonard, he's going to be at our retreat. Some of you have seen him speak and have known him. I love David. He's a student of Kennedy Schultz also. And he started, 19 or 20 years ago, he started a religious science church in Huntsville, Alabama. All right. And I remember him telling me that in his first month there, giving these ideas to the people in Huntsville, there was somebody who came up to him after the service who offered to take him to a place where there was the actual hole in the ground that Satan used to come up from hell and earth and to go back and forth. He kind of, you know, he said it kind of figures it would be in Alabama, you know. Now, he never took him up on the offer, but he was always kind of interested. Okay. So anyway. Let's have a quick history lesson here about hell, okay? Just so, you know, it might expand your parameters a little bit. Most of us have heard of the word Hades. That was the Greek underworld, if you remember that from college. Hades was actually named after a barren island in the Greek Isles that just had nothing on it, okay? And that came to symbolize a place where people went after they died. But it wasn't a place of punishment. It was just kind of a meeting place where everybody went after they died, much like the Hebrew place called Sheol, S-H-O-E-L. So everybody went to the same place. The afterlife, the underworld, was all very egalitarian. In fact, most of the early underworlds and most of the early teachings were like that. They were just great big waiting rooms, though nobody was quite sure what they were waiting for. They didn't get to that, and everybody went there. The word hell that we use actually came from Norse mythology. It came from the Vikings. Hel was their goddess of death in the underworld, but she wasn't mean or vindictive or evil. She was sort of a supervisor of the big waiting place where everybody went. So this idea of hell as a place of punishment where people ended up after being condemned by God for their bad behavior on earth didn't start till around 500 or 600 BC with the Persian prophet Zoroaster. You may have heard of him. That's when the idea of dualism really took place. Light against darkness, good against evil, God against Satan. And eventually the Jews, the Hebrews on a small scale, but then the Christians and then the Muslims and then the Mormons and then just about everybody else got into the act. So for the Western and the Middle Eastern religions, hell became a very nasty place where bad people got sent as permanent punishment with no chance to ever get out. In Judaism, they actually used the word Gehenna. And once again, there were other offshoots of it. They used the word Gehenna for this hell that we talk about. Gehenna was, in fact, an actual place. It was a garbage dump just south of the city of Jerusalem where they burned the city's garbage, they burned dead animals and all those things. And that same location years before had been a place where the Canaanites did human sacrifices to their gods. So this place, Gehenna, actually became a symbol or a metaphor for a place where the wicked people went after they were judged. Now, in the Eastern religions, in Hinduism and Buddhism, they had their own versions of hell, but for them it was more of a temporary stop on the way to God, sort of a way station that they went through. That's what Christianity eventually used purgatory for, sort of a halfway house for sinners, you know, where little people got a little bit of punishment, but they didn't have to stay there forever. That's what purgatory meant. Anyway, all of this history stuff, once you get into it, really clarifies a bunch of the stuff we hear today, but it's just mythology. It's just a physical, metaphorical representation of a fundamentally sound spiritual idea transformed and sometimes twisted by history, superstition, and the beliefs of different cultures. Of course, in this teaching, we believe that heaven and hell are not physical places. And I don't need to convince you, because if you're here, you know that. But that's not what's important. Just because we can't locate a place on the map and point to it and show people where it is doesn't mean that it can't exist in another form. And the form in which heaven and hell do exist is as a state of consciousness. As a state of consciousness, and it's completely personal to each and every one of us. So it's very, very subjective. What's heaven for you could be hell to me. Opera is a great example, okay? All right, okay. Or watching reality TV, okay? Some people are in heaven, some people are in hell. In fact, this past week, there were three famous celebrities who died, and all three of them are excellent examples of what I'm talking about. Ed McMahon, you know, Johnny Carson's sidekick, Farrah Fawcett, and, of course, Michael Jackson. All three of these people were incredibly talented in their own fields. All of them had incredible success in terms of fame, money, and even relationships at some point in their life. But throughout their lives, which ranged from 50 years up to almost 90 years, as anyone would know who reads People magazine or National Enquirer on a regular basis, okay, throughout their lives, they also had terrible experiences that were closely watched and widely published in terms of divorce, bankruptcy, illness, drugs, legal problems, all of these things. And each one of these things in their life was a different room in the individual hell that they had created for themselves. And for them, it was as real and as painful as anything that Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson ever talked about on a Sunday morning. There's a cute story going around on the internet right now. I don't know if you've seen it or not. It's from none other than Deepak Chopra, beautiful, wonderful Deepak. And he tells a story about a man who gets sent to hell, and he's being shown around all the various horrible places he might have to be for punishment. And he looks in one room, and he sees this 96-year-old codger with this beautiful 22-year-old woman in his lap. And he says to the devil, "That doesn't look like hell to me." And the devil says, "It is for the woman." Okay? You know? It's all a matter of perspective, okay? It's all a matter of perspective. Now, the reason I bring this up leads me to the second major misconception about hell, which is the belief that God sends us there as punishment for our sins. And in my opinion, this is the worst of the three. If I could wave a magic wand and remove one belief from the consciousness of the world, this would be it. Because the idea that God sends its creations to this place is not a divine idea. It is the way most religions control their members. That is, in fact, what it is. The belief that a loving power could abandon any of its creations to eternal pain and suffering for our simple human desires and mistakes is so far beyond the realm of intelligence and compassionate thought that no one with an ounce of true spiritual awareness could ever believe it or accept it. Those people who teach that the power that created us could also condemn us are simply projecting their own judgment and their own self-righteousness into the world, and they try to justify it by claiming that it comes from God. That's very, very simple. Now, it may be a semi-appealing idea sometimes to believe that people who don't follow the same rules we do or who don't behave the way we think that they should behave are going to burn in molten sewage forever. Sometimes that's got kind of a little appeal to it, you know. But that's a belief which has no basis in metaphysical truth. It doesn't improve anyone's behavior, it doesn't make the world a better place, and it doesn't do anything good for anyone. So just in case someone asks you, here's the truth according to this teaching. The divine essence, God's an essence, that's what we talk about, that created us and fills us and actually is what we are made of, this power that we call God, is all-loving, all-forgiving, and it never gets mad at anybody ever, no matter what we do or how often we do it. In fact, this creative power's only intention for every single one of us, and it's not even a conscious intention, it is an automatic intention, because that's the way this power works. It's automatically a power for good. Its intention is that we live our lives expressing the same sense of love and forgiveness and respect and support and generosity of spirit towards everyone, including ourselves, all the time that it gives to us. It's one of the major points of this teaching that we are not punished for our sins, we are punished by them. We are punished by them. In other words, we live in a world governed by the law of cause and effect. It is done unto us as we believe, not by God, but by the laws through which we live. So the thoughts and the emotions that we focus upon are always going to be reflected in our experience. They're going to appear in our life as people and situations and events and conditions. So negative, unhealthy, and fearful thoughts can only create negative, unhealthy, and fearful conditions. That means if our mental processes are out of harmony with our divine self, with our higher self, if you want to call it that, which, by the way, is the same as God's divine nature, that's what our higher self is. If our mental processes are out of harmony with that, then we will find ourselves in hell. We will find ourselves surrounded by problems and difficulties and unpleasant people with lack and limitation and suffering everywhere that we look and everything we do, mentally, emotionally, physically, and spiritually. It may feel hopeless. It may feel like it's going to last forever. We may even feel that God has deserted us or even that God has it in for us. This is the real hell, and it can be just as painful as anything that the old-time preachers ever talked about. But the good news is, as the great Emmett Fox once wrote, the doors to hell are swinging doors. I like that. They swing in and out very easily, and we have the option of going in and or coming out anytime that we want. People who understand the true relationship between us and God have always understood this. In fact, in the Science of Mind textbook, in the chapter, What the Mystics Have Taught, Dr. Holmes writes this. He says, "The mystics have not failed to recognize the presence of evil, but they have separated the appearance from the reality. They have done away with evil as a cosmic entity. No devil, no hell, no torment, no damnation outside of our own state of thought. No punishment outside of that self-inflicted through ignorance, and no salvation outside of conscious cooperation with God." And then he says, heaven and hell are states of consciousness. That means not only that God doesn't send anyone to hell, it means that for God, hell doesn't even exist. It's purely a human invention. The concept of hell is as foreign to this power that knows only good as are the concepts of fear and hate or limitation. These are not problems created for us by God. They are false ideas that we create out of our own fear and misunderstanding. And just like any other shadow or any other illusion in our consciousness, it's only as real for us as we allow it to be. That means because we are the only ones who can create it by what's in our heart and mind, that only we can send ourselves there, and only we can decide how long we're going to stay. And that's the third misconception, which is the belief that hell means eternal, unending punishment, like a roach motel. You check in, you don't check out, okay? The truth is, and this fits perfectly with the teachings of Jesus and Buddha and Muhammad and all of the great spiritual teachers, hell is not permanent any more than any state of consciousness is permanent. Only we can decide what thoughts and beliefs we will allow to stay in our consciousness forever, whether it's hatred, anger, resentment, whatever it is. Only we can decide what emotions we will allow to continue to feed our thoughts and our beliefs forever and ever. Amen. Only us. That means that hell is a state of mind that we find ourselves in whenever we allow our fears and our misguided beliefs to run away with us and take eternal control of our life. It's the place in consciousness that we inhabit when we allow ourselves to act opposite to our higher purpose. Dr. Holmes has a wonderful phrase. He calls hell the phantom abode of our morbid imaginations. I love the phrasing on that. Now, when I was in Catholic school, you know I had to bring this up, okay? The good sisters used to tell us, Kennedy used to call them the brides of Christ, I love that. The good sisters used to tell us, I didn't say it, he did, okay, that the real pain of hell, this was in the catechism, I remember it, the real pain of hell was caused by the realization of our permanent separation from God. That's what the pain of hell was. What they didn't understand, because they were never taught, was that we can never really be separated from God because we are one with it. But we can sure feel like we're separated. And our belief in that separation, even if it doesn't exist, our tendency to turn our back on the source of our power will create the same result in our life as actually being separated. Now, how long will that illusion of separation last? It will last as long as we insist on thinking about the same negative thoughts. It'll last as long as we keep believing the same nonsense we're believing. It will last as long as we allow our heart to be filled with anything besides love. Anything besides love. Now, the physical descriptions of hell are very diverse. You read different books, different cultures. You can see paintings in Rome, paintings in Singapore. I've seen them all. And the physical descriptions of hell range from freezing cold and darkness to silence and complete loneliness to fire and horrible smells and noises. It seems to depend on the climate where the religion evolved. Now, here in the Western world, fire seems to be the choice, the most popular choice, but it's actually a pretty good metaphor. In his marvelous book, The Four Agreements, Don Miguel Ruiz, most of you have read this. He was a South American shaman, so he didn't have the Christian tradition or any of those traditions. He says that an inner fire, and he's not talking about a good fire, he says an inner fire is generated by those emotions that come from fear. They come from fear. And whenever we feel the emotions of anger and jealousy, of envy or hate or abuse of others, we experience that fire burning stronger and stronger within us. We can be in the middle of a crowd of happy, joyful people in a beautiful location with all sorts of wonderful things going on. Everyone around us can be in a heavenly state of mind. And meanwhile, there we are deep in the pit, deep in the pit, eating ourselves up inside. Have you ever felt like that when you're around people? We all have, I'm sure. That is how we can tell that we are the ultimate source of our pain, okay? Which is a very valuable thing for us to realize. You see, whenever we feel this way, and we all do on occasion, we are not being punished. It's just a part of our spiritual growth. That's why it's important for us to realize that we are also the only source of our salvation. The very fact that we can recognize when we are causing our own pain, our own personal hell, when we recognize that something inside of us now wants to get back in harmony with life, with the world, and with other people, when we do that, that is our divine light shining through. And that awareness That awareness is the one mind at work in us and through us. That is the creator of all life doing what it does. It's the presence of God allowing us to choose once again between heaven or hell. It happens every day. Fortunately, once we become skilled at making this choice, we can stop being afraid of what God might do to us and start using this power the way we're supposed to be using it, which is to create a life that's healthy, whole, filled with all the good things that we can imagine. And when we finally learn how to do this, not only will we avoid the loss of heaven and the pains of hell, as it said in the Apostles' Creed, one of the prayers that I grew up with, we will truly be in heaven. We will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. You know, now we may not have a harp. We may not be sitting on a cloud. We may not be walking along streets that are paved with gold, but we will be living our life in a consciousness of peace and joy and love, which is about as far from hell as we can ever hope to be. This is the truth in your life, and this is the truth in mine. And so it is. And so it is. Thank you. Thank you. All right. Let's take a few moments now. Take them in silence. Take the words that resonated something within you. I give them to you freely. Set aside the others for later. And let's know this. Let's know that God is love. God is not a person. God is a presence. It is a process. It is the process of love and life being expressed in the world in an infinite variety of ways. And we are one of those ways. In fact, we are one of the most powerful ways in which the power of love and the power of spirit is expressed in the world. And we have the ability to choose where we will express it, when we will express it, how we will express it, and if we will express it. So as we begin to see this power as what we are, and begin to create from this loving space within us, our life is transformed. The people that we attract into our life are loving, caring people. The places that we go to in our life are wonderful, joyful places where we feel filled with the presence of spirit. Our own physical body takes healthy form, and it heals anything that may have crept in without our noticing it. And we express prosperity and abundance, and we increase that not just for ourselves, but for the world and for everyone in it. That is what we do when we bring love into the world. The only punishment that we ever receive is the punishment that we give to ourselves from our own thoughts. It is when we allow others to think less of us. It is when we allow ourselves to think less of ourselves. So as we refuse to do this and we express this love not just outwardly, we also express it inwardly, that love casts out all fear, all thoughts of punishment, all thoughts of pain and suffering. So I invite you now to take a few moments in the silence of your own mind. And in this silence that we'll do together, if you have something in your life that is causing you pain, a memory, something current, a person, an event, a fear, whatever it is, place that firmly in the center of your consciousness and recognize that it did not come from God. It did not come from outside of you. It has come up from within, and it can go back to the nothingness from whence it came whenever you choose. Take these few moments for yourself. With gratitude for this awareness and a clear understanding of its sacred significance in our life, we accept this truth as our own. We accept the freedom that comes from releasing old negative thoughts. We accept the freedom that comes when we put love in the forefront of our experience. We are grateful for all we have been given and all that we have yet to give. And knowing this, we release this awareness into consciousness, letting it spread out from us, touching the world, and doing its good and perfect work for us from this moment on. This is our truth. We accept it, we release it, and so it is.